Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 26th of January. The podcast with an uncoded format.
Exactly.
What did we talk about this episode?
We talked with the great Tanit Koch, columnist at the New European, about what's been going on in Germany. And I have to say, it was absolutely gripping. She's always good, and she was in fine form, terrific.
Well, she explained a lot to me that
it didn't know. Put it in context.
And then in the second half, we talk about the Oscars.
And we pivoted, as they say, in Westminster to the Oscars.
And your amazing surprise nomination for Best Movie, which will shock readers.
I think it's going to come out of the blue. It's the twist, isn't it?
Well, stick around for the second half, but I think first half is the substance of the podcast,
and then it's me talking rubbish
and then
about movies,
talking crap about movies.
Exactly. What could be better?
What should we call this podcast?
I think it's Germany fighting fascism, isn't it? Something like that.
It is. It's because
exactly it is.
That. Okay, right. Well, that'll do. So this is the Two Matts, episode 30, Germany fighting fascism. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, I think both of us were very struck and a bit inspired by what was going on in the streets of Germany over the weekend.
Indeed.
And maybe we should have a quick clip to remind us of what was going on.
So that is what, a million people, something like
1.4 million people across Germany.
In huge numbers of people there in Berlin. And I think that was from the top of the Bundestag, overlooking, filling the Tiergarten and near the Brandenburg Gate. And, you know, very evocative scenes of hundreds of thousands of people protesting about the rise of a far-right party alternative for Deutschland, the AfD. And we are joined, I'm delighted to say, from Bonn by New European columnist Tanit Koch. Tanit, hello.
Hi, Tanit.
Hi, how are you?
You're going to explain to us what's going on, aren't you?
I'll German-splain, yes.
Tanit is our German-splaining columnist every week in the New European, and she's now going to German-splain a rather serious turn of events in Germany and the German people's reaction to it.
What's going on?
Well, the trigger, which is quite interesting because everybody's talking about the crisis of journalism, etc., the trigger was a great investigative report by a team of fact-checkers and investigative journalists called Correctiv. And they basically infiltrated a meeting, a sort of weird alt-right identitarian off-site, which took place in November near Berlin in Potsdam, where members of the AfD, identitarians, I don't know, some sort of fascist dentist, and even fringe nationalist members of the CDU met and discussed how to remigrate. The term remigration sort of seems to become big in those circles, basically how to mass deport millions of migrants from Germany and also quite a substantial number of so-called non-assimilated citizens, which obviously is blatantly illegal, would be blatantly anti-constitutional. They also discussed how to fundraise for right-wing or far-right-wing influences, how to delegitimize institutions such as the Constitutional Court or public broadcasters. And Collectif published a couple of weeks ago, published a good report, a very, very insightful report about this meeting, which triggered those mass protests and sort of people to take to the streets to support democracy. Because obviously, we shouldn't wait until it's too late. That's basically what caused that sentiment.
I guess the first question to ask, Tanit, is why the AFD has grown in popularity, because it's polling around 23%, I gather, just behind the CDU, CSU. How do we account for that?
I think, sadly, the largest one, and this is why I'm slightly torn looking at those demonstrations, because obviously, as you said, it's inspiring to see people who voice support for democracy, for fundamental human rights on the street, and even the temperatures were freezing. Some of those rallies had to be cut short, like in Hamburg and other places, because there were just too many people. So the organizers had sort of told authorities, yeah, we're expecting maybe 5,000, and then 50,000 or 150,000 showed up. So that was massive and indeed very, very impressive. The thing is, if you sort of from Britain or from the US looking upon Germany, you'd think we're about to sort of be overthrown by an extremist movement, whereas in fact we have probably the most left-wing government we've ever had, who in the coalition says we've already sort of ticked off 2/3 of what we planned for this government period. So I'm afraid to say that from a public perspective, government at the moment is seen as the problem and not the solution, which is why AfD may not seem as an alternative to many people, but certainly as a good way to show another form of protest against the actual policies. So just to give you an example, we had a survey from Allensbach Institute, which is a very renowned pollster doing long-term surveys for decades. And they came up with a poll saying that a vast majority, 70-80% of the people feel that in this country, people who work, who pay taxes, who pay their fees for social security, etc., aren't acknowledged, aren't respected enough. And given the fact that Olaf Scholz, when he campaigned in 2021, used the term respect as sort of the main slogan for his political campaign, which he won or won the elections, there is, I think, a massive disappointment in what's been happening since.
Does this all go back to 2015, Tanit, and the arrival of so many migrants from Syria under Merkel? Is that the sort of root of it all?
Well, it's certainly the root of the AfD's success, because they'd been founded beforehand by, you know the story, some academics were actually anti-euro currency. Professors, business management professors, economists, and they've been sort of driven out of the party eventually by the extreme, definitely extreme side. Part of the AfD is now monitored by our domestic intelligence service, for instance, in Saxony, for being outright extreme and anti-constitutional. But they were below the 5% threshold. You know, we have that threshold to actually be able to enter parliament. And they, in all the polls before 2015 and even by autumn 2015, they were on the verge of being irrelevant, insignificant, minuscule. And then came the refugee crisis, and basically, they started not rocketing through the sky, but they gained more and more and more popularity. But when I say this was sort of 12%, 15%, what we're seeing now, again, in the polls, it's between 20 and 30%. The last state election that we had in Germany, for instance, in Bavaria, you mentioned Hessen, and Hessen is not East Germany. This is not sort of the disenfranchised who had to suffer through the consequences of reunification and unemployment. Hessen is like core West Germany, Frankfurt, capital of our bank, is in Hessen. And AfD came second after the CDU. And it may come first in one of the East German states. We're going to see elections later this year.
What you just said about people wrapping in a whole lot of complaints into a sense of protesting against the status quo and the AfD being the recipient of that protest right now, reminded me somewhat of Brexit inevitably, you know, where people felt like they were given an opportunity to express a broad dissatisfaction at the way their lives were going. And of course, many of which, with no expectation of actually winning the Brexit vote, voted in, you know, almost in the certainty that they weren't going to win, but it was an effective way of protesting. And then, of course, they won. And history is history. How close to that is what's unveiling itself in Germany? How close do you think is the potential for this sense of protest to actually manifest itself into something much nastier?
I think up until a few years ago, it was mostly what you just analyzed, protest, and the best way to annoy sort of the ruling class, the elites, and to show them the middle finger was to vote for AfD. Not because people particularly liked it, knowing full well that's it's a nasty party, quite frankly speaking. The leadership is not, it's not sympathetic or amicable in any way, sort of cool people you'd like to hang out with and have it be. Nigel Farage, by the way, is far more popular in a positive sense than the AfD leadership, and we're lucky we don't have a Farage here. But according to analysis, surveys, polls that were sort of taken just after the last two state elections, which are quite representative of the country last year, it's now sort of 50% who vote for AfD for protest reasons, and the other 50% because they're actually convinced that's the right way to go, the far right way to go. So this means effectively that they're not going to go away, because often if the reason to be frustrated and annoyed with the government goes away, then sort of that those parties or movements or whatever might go away too. If they've started sort of convincing people what they do, difficult to get rid of.
Tanet, it's interesting that you say that it's fortunate there's no Farage. There's quite a lot of light on Alice Weidel in the press in the UK at the moment, not least because she just did a Financial Times interview in which she said, you know, yes, that Brexit was dead right and she'd certainly be willing to consider backing a German equivalent. She's a co-leader of the AfD, and she's an unusual face for the AfD, at least superficially. You know, she's a young 44-year-old. She's in a gay civil partnership with a woman of Sri Lankan heritage, has two kids, a background at Goldman Sachs, the Bank of China. Is she a serious sort of figure to be concerned about because of her sort of plausibility, or actually would they be better off with a kind of entertainer, a charismatic figure like Farage?
Charismatic is the word I was looking for. So she is not charismatic. She is very intelligent. She's eloquent. But you wouldn't necessarily want to go out, have a beer with her. And I think we're in luck. If we had some, like a Farage, that would make AfD maybe even more dangerous. So I was intrigued by that Financial Times interview and the what she called Dexit, so that they might consider sort of moving Germany out of the EU, because this would be the single most helpful approach to actually get rid of AfD, because Germans overall are so massively pro-European. I'm saying this is sort of status quo now. This may change in 20 years' time when people feel, okay, why are Hungarians and Polish sort of getting what they want? Why are we paying for it all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? It started differently in Britain too in the 1990s, and then Brexit happened in 2016. So I would never dare to go and predict what the public sentiment will be like in 10 years' time and 15 years' time. But at the moment, and even Marine Le Pen in France eventually figured sort of leaving the EU is not really a hit when it comes to electoral campaigns. And at the moment would be a killer for AfD, which isn't saying that some of the things they are voicing aren't, and that's the trouble, aren't right. The European Union is incapable of solving the migration crisis in a way that is sustainable, sort of keeping human rights in, as well as our sort of social welfare system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in a sort of balanced way. And if you look at, for instance, Ukrainian refugees, and people in Germany know those numbers, it's not that suddenly 30% of the country has turned right-wing extreme. That's definitely not the case. You have a certain number of people who are racist, who are xenophobes, but to say, oh, these are all sort of fascist weirdos who go vote for AfD is taking part of population just not seriously. So look at Ukrainian refugees. we have the statistics who say that in Poland and the Czech Republic, for instance, around two-thirds of the Ukrainian refugees have been integrated into the labor market. In UK, Ireland, it's more than 50%. In Denmark, it's 74%. Germany, 18%. So we only have 18% of more than a million Ukrainian refugees actually integrated in the labor market. Same, nearly the same in Switzerland and Austria, interestingly, German-speaking countries. So one of the reasons why people think this is that our social welfare measures are so incentivizing them not to work that simply they don't. Another reason, and I think it's a mix of both, is that bureaucracy, because in Denmark they also receive a lot of social welfare, but they do work, that our bureaucracy is just impossible to maneuver through if you're Ukrainian, so you'd rather not bother and stay at home. And people see that, and with energy costs rising, cost of living rising, which interestingly, if you work and pay taxes and pay for your own, I don't know, heating, etc., and the heating cost goes up, you have to pay for it. If you are on social welfare and heating costs go up in Germany, you don't have to pay for it because the state will cover your energy costs. So I think a vast part of AfD's popularity is that nagging feeling, what about me? Who cares about me? Why aren't those people in charge doing a lot more for me and not just for the Ukrainians, asylum seekers, etc.? And we have to be very careful because those sentiments, my government cares more for other people than for myself, is it can turn toxic at some point. So I think Olaf Scholz and, for instance, his Minister for Labour Affairs, etc., they're seeing it, but I'm afraid they don't really have the means to change anything quickly.
Tanit, the German constitution is very different from ours. Is it like
I thought you don't have one, actually.
We don't have a constitution, uncodified constitution. But it's described as a defensive democracy in that there are structural ways of combating anti-constitutional behaviour. And one of those is that a constitutional court can ban political parties. And it's happened a couple of times in history. But my question is that viable with a party that is polling one in four Germans? You know, can a court say, well, we're just going to ban it? Because that then raises a question about, well, what kind of democracy have you got if you're completely wiping out the voting intention of 25% of the population?
So legally, of course, it's possible, because that's why, and you said it, the German constitution, Grundgesetz, is defensive, combative even. It does not want to be abolished by its enemies, like in the Weimar Republic. This is one of the lessons we took from Weimar. So if a party fulfills the criteria for being banned, then yes, it can be banned, no matter whether it's polling at 50%, at 60%, or at 80%. That's the legal and not just the legalist view. However, you mentioned party bans having happened, which is very true, in the 1960s. That was the last time, I think, was the Communist Party and an ultra-right nationalist sort of
the successor to the Nazi party. That's right.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And ever since then, the Constitutional Court has made it very clear that they'd rather refrain from banning parties because politicians should sort of sort that out in the usual democratic process for the reasons you just mentioned. Can a democracy really afford to just ban maybe opinions voiced by parties they're not comfortable with, or basically have a government party get rid of the political competition? So this is extremely difficult. And we've lately seen it with the NPD, which is a basically predecessor, far-right extreme predecessor of the AfD. And government and other parties tried to have it banned for 20 years, eventually not being successful in banning it because the Constitutional Court said, well, by now it actually is fulfilling all the criteria. It is openly anti-constitutional. It wants to abolish the democratic German order. But it's completely insignificant. It's irrelevant. It doesn't have, even if it wants to do that, but it doesn't have the power to do it because it's so small by now. You can't ban it. What happened now was that they're going to be banned from tax cuts and any public funding.
Okay.
But people now thought, okay, now that's what we can do with AfD. But the criteria are the same. So I thought when the chairwoman of the German Social Democrats, Esken, recently voiced that we should think about banning AfD I thought it was just one of the most stupid things you could say in the current situation, because AfD is of course going, wow, they're so scared of us, they want to ban us, look, we're going to be the martyrs of democracy, they hate you, this is why they want to ban us. It was that's the state of German sort of the governing party,
and certainly echoes there of Donald Trump's approach in positioning himself. Yeah,
obviously. Yeah. yes.
There's one other thing I wanted to ask, which is the convention of the firewall that CDU, CSU, centre-right parties don't align themselves with parties that are considered to be far-right.
And far-left.
And far-left.
CDU goes both ways.
Indeed. Do you think there's any prospect of that firewall being broken, or at least becoming more porous as the AfD grows? Because, you know, CDU, CSU are ahead. You know, they're leading in the polls, but they haven't got a coalition partner at the moment, do they?
Well, I think you have to first differentiate between different sort of political levels. You have the federal level, you have the state level, you have regional levels, you have local levels. On local level, city councils, town councils, you already see cooperation, not just of CDU, even of the Green Party with AfD, because you can't run a village any other way, depending on the majority. So sort of having a vote on shall we get a new bus stop at that corner, people already, no matter which party, and there are proven cases of people voting either with AfD or AfD voting with them. So on that local level, you do see, for sheer necessity of sort of making things work, you see cooperation with AfD. State level, federal level, CDU is ruling out, and interestingly, that's why I mentioned ruling out sort of cooperating either with the far left or the far right, where the Social Democrats never had a firewall towards the far left, which, by the way, didn't help them sort of cooperating with the former GDR's socialists. I'm afraid that we're going to see a very tricky phase this autumn when we have those state elections, because the CDU might be, well, by sort of media commentators and then other parties, be pushed to prevent AfD to form a government with the left, like the far left, which for the CDU is equally dangerous as cooperating or having a coalition with the AfD. So they are really between a rock and a hard place. Obviously, we don't know the outcome of those elections yet. Could be surprised. But so far, I think, again, on state level, on federal level, I think the firewall is going to hold, because the CDU has a lot of mostly moderate voters. So all the far right wingers, they've already left, they lost them to the AfD. So they might lose an enormous number of voters and even party members if they cooperated with a nasty, nasty party. And that's sort of the tricky situation. And if they want a policy change, and if you look at polls and surveys and why people are frustrated, they want a policy change. And at the moment, the moderate left, the left, the Greens, aren't really offering that any way of the policy change. The Social Democrats are basically run by their youth organization, which is definitely far left of centre. And the tiny liberal free market liberal party is too small to form a majority government with the CDU. And that's, I think, one of the most decisive questions. You find political analysts who say that eventually the CDU may have to be tolerated by AfD, find some sort of agreement like that. I think it's still too early to say. And my hope would be for a more sort of sensible social democratic policy to sort of be more popular among their own circles. The last federal election, the AfD, I think, had around 13%. And they fared better among labor union members than among the general public. So they were more popular with labor union members who are traditionally SPD, social democratic voters. And that's something that the SPD should think about and not sort of start finger pointing toward the CDU for allegedly sort of supporting AfD policies or helping them. I think this is actually a left of center problem as much as it is a right of center.
I guess there's something to be said for at least the problem is in a box with the AfD, you know, whereas in Britain, you've seen the sort of hard right policies of the Brexit Party and Reform, this kind of nastiness bleed into the mainstream Conservative Party and become mainstream policy because they are guided by the popularity of the extreme party and they want to adopt those policies. Is that a risk? Is that what you're saying, that there's a greater risk actually of the mainstream parties saying, well, do you know what, maybe we better adopt a bit of that because it's clearly winning, you know?
Well, it depends what you define as nasty. And if you ask somebody who's not me, they might as well say, yeah, it's already bleeding in, because look at Olaf Scholz. He's given an interview to Der Spiegel saying we have too many irregular immigrants and we need to raise the number of sort of deportations, which again won't help, because he won't get those numbers to any level compared to the level of people coming into the country. So this is a wider European problem, which, as said before, is hard to. So if you ask other commentators, they say, oh yeah, the left-wing government is already, and he's been accused of that just last week by one of the Friday for Future activists, saying that he's using a far-right or right-wing rhetoric. Then secondly, far-right and right in Germany is quite often not differentiated. So the rallies we talked about earlier, they're often called rallies against the right, die Rechte, because Rechte is seen as a synonym by many people as far-right extreme. So we have a problem in this country that if you have sensible conservative positions, rule of law position, that would not be considered far-right in the UK, for instance, can easily be sort of dubbed far-right or rechts here. So it's sort of delegitimizing certain policies that are not nasty and not far-right. You don't have to be of the same opinion. You can see it quite differently. But the problem with the political rhetoric is that quite often sort of left of center is trying to merge everything that is not left of center as, oh, this is all far-right and this is all basically Nazi-dom. And this doesn't go down well with the general public, who are quite commonsensical. And I'd hope for the government to be commonsensical again as well.
Just last question for me is, I've read analogies in English-speaking media with the expose of the conference of the AfD with the Wannsee conference in Potsdam, where obviously the final solution was discussed. Now, can you just put that into context and either dismiss it or say, well, there's something to think about there?
Dismiss it. If you look at the Wannsee conference, if you know your history, look at the numbers. You don't have, and not the numbers, the names. That was the elite of the ruling party of the state at the time. And you didn't have to Google their names, those names, Heidel said that they were known. I had to Google the names of the people taking part at that Potsdam conference. I think the analogy was made because the Wannsee is there, it's 8 kilometers distance. So, you know, we're journalists, we sometimes sort of find analogies where there aren't any. I think it's dangerous because it's sort of relativizing or belittling what actually happened at the Wannsee conference, which was the discussion about the final solution and killing billions and millions of people.
And you had Eichmann and Heydrich leading the field.
Exactly.
Didn't you?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And not some, there was an, I think, some Austrian identitarian who's known, if you know those identitarian circles, and apparently we can't do without Austrians in our sort of extreme alt-right circles. There was an assistant of Alice Weidel present, but this was not sort of the creme de la creme of anybody sort of in the executive or party. Nevertheless, it's dangerous. It must be monitored. Just one last remark for me, and that's another reason why I'm sort of torn by looking at that, those very positive pro-democratic rallies. After October 7th, where we had an actual mass killing, mass rape of people, where we had swastikas painted at houses in Germany again, because Jewish citizens lived in there. The maximum of people at a rally was 10,000, some say 30,000, but people there said 10,000 at the Brandenburg Gate. And now to see 150,000, 200,000 in Munich and Berlin, Hamburg, it just makes me wonder, and I can't explain that yet, why the event, the atrocious event of October 7th, did not get more people on the street back then to be anti-Semitism. Whereas now, because of a nasty, dangerous, awful, but fringe meeting of the alt-right is getting hundreds of thousands to the street, and I don't really know why.
Fascinating to watch. Fascinating. And Tanit, as ever, you have shed so much light on a very complicated subject. And you can read Tanit every single week in the New European with her fantastic German splaining.
Must read.
It's not always as heavy as this. Sometimes,
but it's a must read.
Sometimes Tanit's explaining why you can't hang out your laundry in German.
Or Wagner.
Blocks and stuff like Wagner. Or Wagner the
Brilliant.
Next week. But it's
always, Wagner's heavy though.
it's always a great read. Thank you so much
for joining us
from Bonn.
Thank you, Matt. And thank you, Matt.
See you soon. Bye-bye. Take
care. Thank you soon.
Well, that was fascinating.
No, absolutely fascinating. And I think there are so many questions coming out of that, which are really intriguing.
And I keep trying to compare Britain and Germany in my head as Tanit's talking. But of course, I guess underpinning everything that's going on in Germany is the history.
Yes.
And that adds a prism to it, doesn't it?
That, and I think as Tanit said, there is a question which I find myself increasingly worried about, but knowing we have to deal with it, which is, what is the progressive answer to border control?
Yeah.
Because Labour has just come up with, smash the gangs. I mean, they're coming up to an election, they don't want to. But actually what we need to do is press the reset button and come up with a compassionate, well-funded, well-resourced, non-Rwanda, non-populist answer to this. Because there's going to be so much population mobility in all over the world, from America to Germany to here. This is the issue that keeps coming up. And, you know, if I do have a criticism of progressive parties and progressive commentators, we haven't answered this question in a way that responds to it.
Well, wouldn't it be nice if somebody said, do you know what? We want our economy to grow. We need more people in our economy.
Absolutely.
There are people gagging to get here. I mean, let's get them in and put them to great use.
Step one is to say, I understand your concerns, but let me explain why this is necessary and good.
Yeah. This is why it keeps coming back to me about, and I do accept the argument around our communities changing at the pace that is unacceptable for some people, right? But if you could just get over the Polski shops and that sense and appreciate the greater good, then we'd be in a better place, I think.
I agree. And I think that one of the reasons that Take Back Control was such a dangerous and clever slogan in 2016 was that actually immigration has become a proxy for people's fear of change. I don't think most British people dislike their Polish neighbours or their Afro-Caribbean neighbours. Quite the opposite.
Yeah.
But I think that it's become a kind of a metaphor, and dangerously so.
Yeah.
And we need a progressive government to, much of it's managerial and money, but also a narrative that says this has long been a diverse country, and it's going to stay being a diverse country. And you know what? That's a good thing.
I keep thinking about the Vietnamese boat people back in the 70s and how I know the numbers were much, much smaller, but the whole idea of welcoming in
Ugandan Asians,
you know, the Windrush generation, obviously they had to go through huge pain, but now are accepted as absolutely intrinsic to the fabric of this nation.
Folks, you know, you are the country of Cable Street.
Exactly right. Well, on that uplifting note, we're going to take a totally different twist for the part two, and we're going to discuss Movies and the Oscars. Join us in a few minutes after this short break.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday was the anniversary of George W. Bush's Axis of Evil speech.
Then Tuesday marked the day that Oliver Cromwell was executed, despite having been dead for 2 years.
On Wednesday, the debut of the first TV soap opera in 1949.
On Thursday, we uncover the 19th century club for stoners.
And on Friday, Gobbler's Knob saw its first ever Groundhog Day.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Two Mats podcast, brought to you by The New European. The New European is the paper standing against the kind of right-wing, nationalistic, corrosive politics and media that we've seen drag this country down over the last few years. And if you want to do something positive about the state of the nation, then support our independent journalism. And you can do it for less than £1 a week. For £1 a week, you get all of the digital offering and our great new app. But for another £1, you can get the newspaper delivered every single week straight to your door. And that's a saving of more than 75% on the cover price. And it's the best way to support what we do. So please consider subscribing. Just go to www.theneweuropean.co.uk/2MATTS. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. There's a link in the show notes. And it'll be the best spent pound a week you make this week.
In this year of all years.
In this year of all years.
Go for it. It makes sense.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns. Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
And welcome back.
Welcome back.
So, Matt, big week in movie world.
Big week in movie world. Oscar nominations announced on Tuesday.
Should we have a little Simon Mayo, Mark Kermode moment?
Well, here's the thing is that I think it's the main takeaway, although it hasn't been the main story in the press, is it's just an amazing year for film.
So it's been great,
Just to list the nominees for Best Picture. American Fiction, which I haven't seen, stars Jeffrey Wright. Anatomy of a Fall, which I gather you saw just now.
I watched it yesterday and I thought it was fantastic because my wife watched it and hated it. Thought it was dull and boring, couldn't work out what the fuss was about. But I have a theory. I think there was something about my interest in judicial process. So the French legal criminal system is markedly different to the British legal criminal system.
Inquisitorial.
And I was fascinated by
that.
It's
great, isn't it?
And so I thought the second half was great. But also, if you make any movie about anything and put a suffering child in it, I am an absolute
wreck.
I'm a wreck by the end of it. Yeah. So it had me on that score as well.
So that, which is great. Barbie.
Yeah.
The Holdovers. The 1970s nostalgia fest, which you will love.
Yeah.
Paul Giamatti, playing Paul Giamatti. Yeah. Killers of the Flower Moon, the Scorsese epic.
What did you make of that?
Well, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I don't think it's going to win. I mean, it's very hard not to like Scorsese.
And De Niro was great.
Maestro, the Bradley Cooper, Leonard Bernstein biopic. Oppenheimer, of course, which I'm taking a vow not to go on about too much. Past Lives, which was is a gem.
Speed
Songs movie. Beautiful film.
Yeah.
Poor Things, Yorgos Lanthimos' latest crazy fest.
Yeah, I haven't seen this one yet.
Which you'll enjoy. And then The Zone of Interest, which is the adaptation by Jonathan Glazer of Martin Amis' novel and is a very, very dark and brilliant and compelling movie about Auschwitz. So it's the only category that all 10,500 members of the Academy can vote on. I was looking back through the lists for, you know, are there comparable years? And 1940, they called it the outstanding production in those days, which I love. It's very 1940s. And that year, the nominees included Gone with the Wind, which won, Wizard of Oz, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Stagecoach, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and Mice of Men. Pretty good.
Isn't that amazing, though?
Yeah.
All of those films I've seen and I'm they're familiar all great. With, and they're still current, really.
Right. They're all great. That's incredible. And then another year, which was amazing, was 76. The list was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which won. Barry Lyndon, great Kubrick film. Dog Day Afternoon, Al Pacino.
Yeah, amazing film.
Jaws.
Yeah, I've heard of that one.
and Nashville, you know, amazing. Yeah. So my view is that the big thing we should be feeling is, in spite of all the warnings that cinema was dead, it really isn't. And not only that, movies of great worth and variety are being
made. Well, the variety is the word I'd pick on.
Tremendous.
The spectrum of quality. So, from Barbie to Oppenheimer.
Such good news.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And the tally was Oppenheimer gets 13 nods, Poor Things gets 11, Killers of the Flower Moon gets 10, Barbie on 8. So they're the leading pack.
Big question, what's going to win it?
Well, I think Oppenheimer is the favourite. You hear a bit of buzz at the edges about holdovers. It's impossible to know because it's the only category that all 10,500 members of the Academy vote on.
Yeah,
the voting system is complicated and
corrupt as well,
and controversial. You know, and this of course brings us on to the row, because there is always a row. And there should be sometimes. So the row that was necessary, I think, was Oscars So White in 2015, because it really was, you know, scandalously neglectful of African American talent. And when you think about the American cinema, you know, you've got, and indeed the global cinema, you know the importance of black directors now. You know, Steve McQueen, Barry Jenkins, Spike Lee, Ava DuVernay, Jordan Peele, Ryan Coogler. You know, the Oscars needed to pull its socks up, and it has to a big extent. But there's also a danger now where we've reached a point with the Oscars where everyone is excited about the Cap-S snub.
Uh-huh.
Who's been snubbed?
Yeah.
You know, and people are more excited about the snubs than the nominations.
Yeah.
And I think you have to remember is it isn't always a snub if you're not nominated, you know? It's subjective judgment.
And the big subjective snub then was Barbie, right?
Of course, yeah. Barbie, because neither Greta Gerwig in the Best Director category nor Margot Robbie in the Best Actress category were nominated. Now, just to break that down, it is true that the Best Director category is probably the most sort of conservative traditionally. It's a very small electorate of 587 voters, of whom only a quarter are women.
Right.
However, if you look at the bigger picture, you know, Justine Triet for Anatomy of a Fall is amongst the nominees. So it's not that they left out women completely.
Yeah.
Also, Greta Gerwig, who I have been following with complete admiration since she was in Greenberg with Ben Stiller and Frances Ha in 2012, which is a marvellous film. She's a great director and has been nominated for Best Picture twice before, Little Women and Lady Bird.
Yeah.
She is nominated as a producer. For Barbie. And she's also nominated with her other half, Noah Baumbach, for the Best Adapted Screenplay. So, you know, she might come away with a statuette.
Well, just explain one thing to me then. What is the fundamental difference in criteria or judgment or whatever between Best Picture and Best Director?
The honest answer to that is the demographic of the electorate.
Right.
So you get 10,500 people voting, or almost, it's the closest thing the Academy gets to a popcorn judgment, which is the movie we really like, which is why when Parasite won, it was such a thrilling and exciting and unusual thing, because, you know, Parasite was an art house movie, Korean movie, and, you know, it really took people aback. So I think it's open, you know. I mean, Barbie could win. I mean, the interesting thing about that list is that every single movie on that list is a plausible winner.
Yeah.
Whatever they announce, no one will be entitled to say that's an outrage, that's a scandal.
Are the votes already in?
I don't think so.
So is it possible?
No, they're not. No.
So they're not. So people could react and say, oh, I think someone's going
to get
that, but we'll vote
for
this.
If, for example, people feel that it is totally outrageous and patriarchal that, you know, Ryan Gosling was nominated for Ken in the Best Supporting Actor role, whereas Margot Robbie wasn't in the Best Actress, then they can vote for Barbie as Best Picture.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I genuinely don't think that this is an example of sort of wicked patriarchy.
No.
I mean, people may disagree. But just going down the list of firsts, just to demonstrate that the Academy is not, you know, wicked. Lily Gladstone, Best Actress, first Native American woman to be nominated for that category. for Killers of the Flower Moon. Colman Domingo has a wonderful performance in a movie called Rustin, about Bayard Rustin, who is a gay member of the civil rights movement, very close to Martin Luther King. It's on Netflix. It's really good. Didn't get much play at all. And he's the first Afro-Latino man ever to be nominated for that category. Right. Then another movie that hasn't been very prominent but is wonderful, called Naiad, about the swim of a woman from Cuba to mainland Florida. Jodie Foster's been nominated for that in the supporting category. And Annette Bening has been nominated for the lead role in that. And the point about Jodie Foster is it's the first time two LGBT people have been nominated for playing LGBT characters. And to keep going, for the first time, three foreign language movies have been in the running for Best Picture: Past Lives, Anatomy of a Fall, and The Zone of Interest. And last but not least, it's the first time in Academy history that three of the 10 movies nominated for Best Picture, Anatomy of a Fall, Past Lives, and Barbie, were directed by a woman.
Wow. Okay.
So, I genuinely don't think you can look at that list and say it's not diverse. It's not.
It's a bit mad, the row over Barbie, isn't it? But
I think so. I mean, I think that some of it has looked a bit performative to me, to be honest, which is there's a kind of glee about it. We told you so. I mean, Barbie is cleaning up at the in the awards,
cleaning up at the box office as well,
and you know, really, yeah, and I think it's important, you know, no one is entitled to a nomination.
No.
And I really don't think that what's kept out Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie in this case is some sort of sinister patriarchal plot in this, but that would have been plausible 10 years ago. I'm not sure it's plausible now. I must say actually that I was much more angry when Margot Robbie was not nominated for Babylon last year, because that was I thought her performance in that was off the charts amazing.
Yeah.
But that's, again, this is the point, it's a subjective thing, and you're never going to, and you shouldn't, reduce Oscar nominations to a kind of tick box thing. You do want representation and inclusion, of course you do, but there will always be an element of subjectivity in it that just is.
Do you think they still matter like they used to? Because they're not on, I mean, they're a news story the next day, aren't they? Number three on the BBC News, and then the world moves on, unless you're nerds like us and you.
Yeah, I think that, look, they probably help movies have a second sort of wind. I mean, I noticed that Oppenheimer is being re-released. IMAX is all over the world, so whichever wins, it's a bit like the Booker Prize, there'll be a push with it. You're right to imply that it perhaps doesn't have the kind of velocity behind it that it used to. One thing it does do is there's a very funny line in Brian Cox's, as in Succession, Brian Cox's memoirs about what happened when he played Hannibal Lecter first.
Yeah, that's right, I remember.
In a movie called Manhunter. And then the role went to Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
And Anthony Hopkins won the Oscar. And Brian Cox says in his memoirs, very amusingly, he didn't mind Anthony Hopkins winning the Oscar, but it did bother him to this extent that your fee as an actor goes up exponentially.
Right, Oscar winner,
Anthony
Hopkins.
Once you've got that statuette,
and
they can put on the posters of all your films, however rubbish, Academy Award winner Anthony Hopkins, you get the knighthood and you get a big pay rise. So I think they do matter on that, to that extent. Yeah. You know, they're a kite mark. And the fact that we're talking about it, and the fact that there was a big if confected row about Barbie already this week shows that to some extent they matter. And I think, to be honest, Jimmy Kimmel's going to be presenting them for the second year in a row.
Is he? Oh, brilliant.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that they're still hoping after the Will Smith slap of Chris Rock in 2022.
Amazing. They'll never top that.
No, but I think they're just hoping things go calmly and without, you know, ultra violence. But, you know, to your point, I mean, they are not, they haven't got the punch they used to, but they still, but they do matter.
Yeah.
And people do talk about them. And it's wonderful that they do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, streaming and COVID and all these things have, you know, added fresh pressures to the movie business. And yet it refuses to die. And that's terrific, I think.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, the fact that all of those films All of them. I mean, I've seen five of them, I think. You've seen all but one. But they're all incredibly watchable,
yes,
good films, but for incredibly different reasons.
Yes.
You know, Anatomy of a Fall, I was in pieces at the end of it, but it was one of the most compelling kind of human, intimate human dramas. You know when you watch a film and you know it's been written as a play to start with?
Yes.
And I don't know whether that one had been. I don't think it had, but it had that.
It is a chamber piece, quality, isn't it?
It is a beautiful chamber piece. And then you pan that over to something as epic as Oppenheimer.
Yes.
You know, I'll tell you one thing I was glad about, because it kind of confirmed my suspicions having left the cinema after Napoleon, was that Napoleon didn't feature in any of these lists apart from costumes and
he
stuff
was
like this.
Snubbed.
You know, but it still has that. So there is a sort of integrity, I guess, in the list, isn't it? That it doesn't matter how big the scale of the project is. If it's not great work, then it's not going to.
Yeah,
feature.
I mean, I think actually they were spoilt for choice this year.
Yeah,
so,
definitely. Yeah.
You know, Todd Haynes' May December, which is a great movie, only got one nomination for Best Screenplay. And one of the films of the year, which is just opening now in the UK, All of Us Strangers with Andrew Scott,
yeah,
and Paul Mescal, directed by Andrew Haig, picked up six nominations at the BAFTAs, didn't get anything at the Oscars.
Amazing.
And in another year, that would be in the running for Best Picture. It's a fantastic film.
Let's just talk for a second before we close off about a film that probably most people haven't seen yet because it hasn't been out for long, is The Holdovers.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
Which is essentially a Christmas movie, isn't it?
It is. And, well, it is literally a Christmas movie.
But it's by directed by Alexander Payne.
Who was Sideways.
My favourite film, I think.
And reunites him with Paul Giamatti.
Yeah.
As Paul Giamatti. And it's very beautifully shot, grainily, and with lots of retro features as a 1970 movie.
Yeah.
And it's about a private school in America where Giamatti is the teacher.
Yeah.
And he is, for various reasons, compelled to be the poor teacher that has to stay around in the school to look after the kids who can't go home
for Christmas.
Over Christmas.
Right.
And that's really all it is.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very affecting and beautiful film, very funny.
Great.
And I can't recommend it highly enough. And excellent. I think it's a sort of side bet, actually. I mean, it's timed quite well because it's a talker at the moment. So
uh-huh.
I'd be surprised if it won Best Picture, but it wouldn't be ridiculous.
And if you had to hand the award over...
Oh, come on. I mean, that's a ridiculous question.
Boom!
I don't want to go any further down that rabbit hole than I have to. It's bad enough for my family that I have to do it all the time.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for that. When is the big night?
It is in March.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll come back to it. See how well we did with our...
March the 10th.
March the 10th. Guys. All right, folks. There's the Oscars, March the 10th. Thank you for listening to the Two Mats podcast brought to you by The New European. Please get in your questions, any feedback to the2mats@tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2, MATTS@tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can easily message us there. Very, very quick and easy to do. And that's exactly what South Nick did, who says, "Do most journalists leave their political views at the office door? Matt D'Ancona presents centre/centre-left views on the podcast, but his past jobs have been much further to the right. Do they, Matt? Do you leave your political views at the door and pretend to be a Marxist revolutionary in print?"
I'm an international man of mystery.
I must say,
as you
I
know.
Haven't noticed the massive switch.
I'm a Marxist comedian.
Yeah. I mean, the answer is absolutely they do on some titles.
Yes.
But never on The New European.
Not on The New European.
We don't want them to do that. We want them to shoot from the hip. We are back with a new Q&A episode on Sunday. And remember, our new subscription offer, just go to thenew.co.uk/2mats. There's a link in the show notes. And if you like this podcast, you will love The New European. Support us by subscribing. Thank you to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, ably assisted by Ollie Peart. And until next week...
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him. Goodbye. It's
the other way around, isn't it?
No.
No, sorry. Yeah.
That's it.
Sorry,
that's it. And we'll cut that one out for the bloopers show.
Yeah, the Christmas right. Bloopers.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you. Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.